Howdy, folks, friends on the River of Suck swim team, and welcome new listeners to the River of Suck podcast. I'm your host, Andy Reiner. We've got a super special guest today, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion strategist, trainer, speaker, artist, and consultant, Parker, aka Queen Work. And I'm ridiculously excited to share this conversation with you and your ears, and perhaps tickle your brain. Before we jump in, I want to share with you something that has helped me cross my own rivers of suck. Every day is another chance to move in small steps towards our goals, but waking up, getting going, feeling the flow state, and finding that high level of focus on our goals to reach the other side is always a challenge. Taking the river of suck seriously in your life requires concentration and hard work, so I'm always looking for ways to move past the brain fog and get her done. I started drinking these little green shots called Magic Mind in the mornings, and they really helped me get in the right state of mind for a productive day. I feel way better in the mornings, and I'm happier throughout the day thanks to the adaptogens that boost your mind and help you relax. I had been buying healthy mushroom pills for immunity and mental performance, but I'd rather drink it alongside my one cup of coffee in the morning. It reduces my need for additional caffeine in the afternoon with ingredients like matcha, ashwagandha, lion's mane mushrooms, and cordyceps mushrooms. Seeing how well it works for me, I would encourage you to try it out if you're struggling to feel 100%. It's a total game changer. So, I've got a 20% off code to share with you guys. It is RIVER20, all caps, RIVER20, you know, 20, the number, RIVER20. To use it, head over to magicmind.co/river and make it happen for you. This is also going to stack with their subscription discount for up to 56% off the one-time purchase price, and Magic Mind has a money-back guarantee, so if you're not feeling it, no worries. Once again, that code is RIVER20, and the website is magicmind.co/river. Welcome to the River of Suck podcast, episode 30. We are live here with Queen Work, Parker.
Hi,
that's
Andy.
That's right. And we are at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge.
Yes.
We are off the grid. This is the first ever.
By this beautiful lake.
Yeah, we're by a lake, and there's a bird stretching.
It's nature. There's nature all up in here.
Wings,
it's amazing.
On a rock. Look at that.
Yeah.
We're not allowed to swim, so the birds can swim.
They got it. It's their land.
That's right. So let's start with, who are you and how did you get here?
Who am I and how did I get here? Oh, my goodness. This is like, it's like a deep question. So my name is Parker, a.k.a. Queen Work. And I'll say that Queen is actually spelled a little bit differently, spelled K-W-E-E-N. Work is spelled W-E-R-K. But Queen is actually an acronym for Keep Widening Environmental Engagement Narratives. How did I get here? And well, I drove today to this beautiful lake. No, I don't know. You know, it's been a journey, and I'm guessing, you know, I like to say I wear a number of different head wraps. Mm-hmm. So in addition to my social media persona of Queen Work, I am also a consultant for diversity, equity, and inclusion issues, working mostly with conservation-based organizations around how do they do good work that reaches all types of community members, right, and is beneficial for all communities. Mm. And I have a tech startup, which
nice.
If folks had told me, you know, 10 years ago you'd be COO of a tech startup, I'd be like, what you talking about, Willis? But folks over 40 probably know that reference. But I am, and the tech startup also is social justice minded. So the tech startup is Inclusive Guide, and it's a website that is a place where people can rate businesses and spaces for how safe, welcome, celebrated they feel in relation to their identity. So it's like Yelp, but for inclusion.
Yeah.
And so Queenwork, Eco-Inclusive, my consulting, and Inclusive Guide all kind of go around this, around these social justice, environmental issues. And I would say that I got to the space of running these three orgs through my own journey through environmentalism and conservation, and what that has meant for me as a Black woman navigating those spaces.
Wow, that's amazing. So I ask every guest here on the River of Suck, what makes you feel like the U.S. you?
What makes me feel like the U.S. you? I think being able to authentically be myself in a space. And so one of the reasons, or like from kind of the things that I laid out, people may already have guessed by now that I'm self-employed, right? I have three businesses that I run myself. And during the time that I've been able to be self-employed and run those businesses, I feel like I have been the me-est me, the U-est you. I've spent a lot of time in spaces where I couldn't be myself. And I think that everybody kind of goes through that, right? You get your first job, you work in kind of maybe corporate areas or nonprofits. I worked in nonprofits. They might as well a lot of times have been corporations.
Right.
And you kind of do the math when you come into a space about, you know, what's expected in the culture of the organization.
Sure.
And you try to like live up to that. But I also had like an extra layer being that where I worked in mostly conservation-based nonprofits in a field that is predominantly white, showing up as a Black plus-size femme-presenting woman, really, I needed to kind of shift a lot of the things. You know, I used to wear head wraps in college. I got into the field. I was like, oh, I probably shouldn't wear my hair like this. I don't see anyone else doing it. I was like, oh, the gear that I usually rock, like bright colors, whatever, like that's not gonna fit into this. I better buy a fleece. I need to tone down my makeup, tone down the earrings that I wear. I need to present a certain way. I also like my experiences in nature, and my connection to nature was very different from a lot of my colleagues. And I realized that some of the things that I said or talked about, they were not connecting with. So I needed to kind of change the way that I presented myself in these spaces in order to be successful, in order to keep going in my career. And I wore that mask for a very long time. And it wasn't until I started getting into leadership positions that I really felt like I could be more myself, because I was the person setting the rules, but I still didn't realize how much I was holding back until I was able to start my own work and have the only person that I answer to be myself.
Right on.
Yep.
Okay, we got to go back in time a little bit. Not back
take
in time.
Back. Let's take it back. Back in time. Get to DeLorean.
Rewind.
Okay.
So you're navigating a lot of spaces, and there's complex layers. So we're going to try and peel back the layers.
Okay.
You want to be the U-est you. You want to be the Parkerest Parker.
Yes.
The queenest work.
The most Parker.
When you come outside, and this is part of your what you're doing in your social media,
yep.
just by being places, is working on making spaces like this more accessible and more welcoming to and more inclusive to all people.
Yeah.
So for me, as someone who appears to be a white straight male, although I am Jewish and I'm not straight, so the
right. What's up, queer club?
There's layers that you cannot see.
Yep.
But you know, for me, I've always felt very welcomed and at home in outdoor spaces. What have you had to go through to feel like you can be yourself?
Yeah.
In the outdoors.
You know, I think being myself in the outdoors is really, I'm able to feel, I think, most myself when I am in a group of like-minded folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I feel like there is a bit of protection and barrier from the way that I am perceived by others just by being in the group and being out and hiking. But I don't always want to do that, right? It's nice to be in nature by yourself.
Yeah.
But when I do get into nature by myself, I do have a little bit of a guard or a little bit of a worry, because that is the time that I get approached the most by other people.
Huh.
And, you know, varying levels of microaggressions or coded language. I often get asked if it's my first hike, even though I hike a lot. I often get asked if I know where I'm going. Sometimes people veer off, like they might be going in another direction. Sometimes people veer off.
Whoa.
They come up to me to just say things like, "Whoa, you're colorful," and then they like walk away. And I've talked to people about that before, and they're like, "Oh, well, it's a compliment." And I was like, "No, like a compliment would be, wow, I really like the colors of your head wrap."
Yeah.
Right? Like that's a compliment, but like, "Whoa, you're colorful" is a you are showing up different in my
right.
space, and I have altered my trail to come up and tell you that mm-hmm. I've noticed your difference in my space, you know, and now I'm walking. And so I get those little things most often when I'm on my own.
Right.
And I think people feel more emboldened if it's just me. And sometimes, you know, there are days, depending on my mood, where I'm just like, "Oh, whatever." Like no, it's not my first hike, but, you know.
Have you seen my social media followers?
Right?
They know.
But, you know, it is, there are days when it does hit hard and I'm like, "Oh, okay, once again, I was out here trying to be cool, trying to chill
right.
in this natural area, and I'm being told that I'm unexpected and different in this space."
Hmm.
So,
yeah, nobody has ever asked me those questions.
Yeah.
and in some cases it's the opposite. And I get some weird, silly questions because I do a thing where I ski every month.
Okay.
So when people are
like every month year round?
Every month year round on glaciers. Because
oh,
Colorado.
Okay.
Because you can.
What?
Yeah.
I went skiing for the first time this year. My butt was really cold.
Was that at Loveland Valley by any chance?
No, it
was. Where was that?
Where'd
you go?
Copper Mountain, I remember. It was Copper Mountain.
Yay, Copper.
Yay, Copper.
they like Copper?
I don't know.
I don't know.
No, we got a couple of...
they're trickling in and out.
Trickling in
yeah,
and out. Hi, folks.
So I'll be walking around in like the middle of July with a pair of skis and boots and all this gear. And then also I really like to wear silly hats.
Yes,
so I have and silly sun protective hats.
Okay.
So it's funny, I have gotten a lot of comments about like just really ignorant comments about like, "Oh, are you just like, oh, you're not really going to ski, right? You're just bringing those up here. It's like, no, we wouldn't carry this all the way up here. We weren't going to go. Look at our tracks. They're right there.
Yep.
Like, oh, my God. But I have noticed that the closer you get to the trailhead, the dumber the comments get and the less water people brought with them.
Yeah.
Do you ever experience like that same kind of the people at the top? Really, they went far. They woke up early.
They know. Yeah.
They know something about something, maybe. Or maybe it's their first hike. I don't know. I'm assuming stuff already. But I have noticed that the trend, that the dumber question, the like, it happens gradually. The questions get weirder and sillier. Is that part of your experience too?
I would say that it is wherever, right? I get it everywhere. And you know, I also get compliments, mm-hmm. which is nice. It is nice when folks are like, "Oh, I like your earrings," you know, or whatever. So it's not all that, but you know, it is interesting. It can happen at the top, can happen midway. folks saying interesting things, right? And I'm not, you know, I have a lot of friends that are folks of color that get outdoors and talk about similar experiences that they've had. I had a friend who took a group of Black kids out hiking, and when they got to their destination and everybody got unloaded and they started up, like they were maybe 10 minutes into the trail where they stopped at their first place, mm-hmm. and there was a gentleman there who kind of scoffed at them and then said to the leader, who is white presenting, I come up here to get away from kids like Whoa. These. So you know, like, people are not, I don't know, I would feel like people would be more afraid to say
yeah.
things, but they ain't scared. They're happy to show themselves.
I think it's really important that people who are not of color hear this experience and understand how many more layers of challenge it is just to go out into the world. You know, it's not something I experience every day. And we have a friend who's an Asian American. And she feels like the lack of diversity in Colorado is, she's moving here from somewhere else, and she is struggling with the idea of not being, having as many of her people around her.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really important that we understand these layers of complexity. When we see people, I want to see people on the trail and project a welcoming vibe, you know.
Yeah.
Try and say hi to people, make sure they're okay. I always have extra everything with me, so if someone's really struggling, here's a snack, here's a La Croix, whatever. But it is really important that people hear about this. And I guess the really important question is, what can we do to make it a more welcoming space? What should we be thinking about?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a few things that we can think about. One is, what is the history, right, of access to the outdoors and how it affects how people enter the mm-hmm. space today, right? So we hold up some folks that did some great things as our leaders when we talk about conservation, but something that we don't often explore is, you know, the duality of being a human. Like, we have good yeah. sides, and we have things that are not great sides, right? So when we think about folks like John Muir, who's touted to be the father of the national parks, and Teddy Roosevelt, Teddy Roro, the conservation president, right? Who did, like, Teddy Roosevelt, like, preserve millions of acres of land, right? John Muir had, like, set forth just kind of thinking that really got people clued into what the wilderness was and what protection of the wilderness needed to be. Both men were racist, and we can't leave out those portions of their background, because it plays into how those systems were formed. So, mm-hmm. you know, John Muir had negative thoughts about Native Americans, about Black people, didn't think Native Americans were fit to be on the land, like they needed to be removed from the land, even though they've been living in harmony with the land for, you know, forever, they needed to be removed from the land. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, said that the Negro wasn't in any way, shape, or form able to take care of himself like the white man is, because if he were, there would be no Negro problem, right? And so they created these systems, and when we create systems, we put into it our own points of view, whether that is in who has access or who we got the land from. Like during the time that we were creating the national park system, Kiowa Chief Lone Wolf was taking the U.S. To court because for breaking the Medicine Lodge Treaty Act, where they had taken just millions of pieces of land. And this tribe, which started out or, you know, near the beginning, I think they started out with more, but they had over 90 million acres of land when it was they started recording this land allotment being taken away. By the time they stopped it, they were down to 3,000 acres and had their land had been taken by eminent domain, by other things, given to settlers, given to other government entities, right? And so we were like, yes, this amazing idea, yet we were taking land from people to create it, right? Black people, we were in the midst of Jim Crow laws, which meant that we could not access a lot of those spaces that were these public spaces for the benefit of all, but Black people couldn't go there. And Jim Crow laws didn't end until 1965, right? And so that legacy still lays, still goes on. Like, I never knew that national parks were a thing until I was in my 20s. Wow. It was not something that I traveled to or did as a kid or that my family ever spoke about, right? My grandmother used to tell me, you don't go into the woods, and you especially don't go alone because that's where bad things happen. She was remembering a legacy of lynching, right? And things that happened there. Still today, like, I was talking to my cousin a couple of weeks ago who told me her younger son, she does not let him go outside alone to play in the outdoors. He has to have at least two other friends, so three of them total, to go out. And she said that it's because one of them has to be able to get away to tell the story. So if something bad happens to him in the outdoors.
Yeah.
And that legacy spread out from the way people were treated and not allowed in certain spaces, right? And so when we look at the way people relate to those places today, we have to remember that history. We also have to think about how those institutions that we have today are affected by those histories. And we have policies and laws that are built into our current institutions that we have to address and understand what is the background that they come with. And then we have to think about how we treat others when we go into those spaces as individuals. You know, how do we disrupt the unconscious bias, the things that are just drilled into us without our knowledge? You know, if we only ever see pictures of certain people in outdoor spaces, if we only ever are connected to certain people that are in those outdoor spaces, how do we have an understanding of, you know, what biases we might have been programmed with, and that then cause us to do a double take when we see someone that's different, or to say something that maybe we don't think of as harmful, but might be reflecting an underlying unconscious bias that we never even knew that we had.
Wow. Yeah. And as an improvising musician, I oftentimes say things right when they come to my mind.
Yeah.
But I'm working on thinking more about how every word I say affects people.
It's so hard. And I'm doing it as well, right? Because I have bias.
Right.
And I have to learn, like, and we all have, all mm-hmm. humans have bias. We are kind of trained
sure.
with that bias. And we don't always, we're not always told to be reflective of that. And so I get hit with things, whether it's like sayings that I've always said my whole life and never thought about the origin, or whether it's, you know, people from other identity groups that, you know, the like, what is the first thought that comes to mind? And then thinking of, well, where did that come from? And why do I have that perception? And, you know, let me like hold back a second because I don't want to say the wrong thing, right? But it can happen. So, and we have to be forgiving of ourselves as mm-hmm. we learn. I think we are often told that we can't be wrong, that we have to get it right, and that if we mess up, it like takes away from us as a human. Oh, you made a mistake. And so people will work really, really hard to never be caught up in the, like, oh, you made a mistake.
Yeah.
They feel bad about themselves. And I think that is what stops a lot of people from engaging in justice, equity, diversity work, because they don't want to make a mistake. And so they'd rather just like leave it alone.
Yeah. Yep. Wow. Well, there's a lot there, and I have more questions about it. But we cannot go any further okay. on the River of Suck podcast without talking about the River of Suck.
Okay.
The River of Suck
is an imaginary river that runs through our mind, and it represents the struggle. We are here on one side of the river. We're on our comfort shore. We're literally on the shore, the comfort shore, at our nice picnic table with crab claws. Whoa, this is gnarly.
It's getting real.
It's so real. You're on your comfort shore. Behind you is your comfort cave, or your comfort tree, or comfort rock pile. Usually it's just the comfort cave, but I'm just looking around. This is where you do the things you already know how to do, stuff that feels easy, your comfort zone. No problem. You got this. Way off in the distance on the other side of the River of Suck, you can see little tiny future versions of yourself who can do the things that you wish you could do now. But they're tiny because they're far away. And in between you and the magical future versions of yourself is the raging, terrifying, intimidating River of Suck.
Yes.
Filled with rocks, whitewater rapids. I'm going to add leeches today.
Yeah, okay, leeches.
And most devastatingly, the thought piranhas, those self-defeating thoughts that race through our heads trying to convince us that we're not good enough. Why should we try? Why should we go out? All the self-doubt thought piranhas.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, you're never going to get to that other side without small steps that we take on a daily, weekly, whatever, long-term basis, small steps we can take that hopefully get us in the direction that we want to go. Because these big, faraway goals seem overwhelming, they seem impossible, and they are if you want to accomplish them in the next 10 minutes.
Okay.
So if yes. we build a raft of good vibes, of good ideas, and believing in ourselves and knowing that these small steps we take will eventually get us to where we want to go, maybe we'll reach the other side. So that's the River of Suck. And again, the question I ask everyone, and I ask you, Parker, today, how do you see the River of Suck in your life? Does that make sense? Have you experienced this?
Yeah. Okay. So River of Suck, I've been trying to think about this in regards to where I am now, where I've been, and where I want to go, right? Yeah. So I would say I talked a little bit earlier about having worked in spaces where I didn't feel like I could authentically be myself,
mm-hmm.
and where I felt like, you know, because of my identity, I'll say that, as a Black woman, and that I face different things, right? When I first started in my conservation environmental education career, right, I constantly had people that questioned who I was and my right to be in a space. And so I would have things like I'd be getting ready to lead a kayaking trip, and I'd have all my boats laid out on the side of a literal river. And people would come up and they would look at me and they would look at the boats and they would look around and they'd say, "Oh, so who's leading our trip today?" Right. Oof. And I'd have to be like, "Oh, I guess it's me," you know. Or, you know, when I was director of education at a site, I often had people mistaken me for like service positions. So either housekeeping or the kitchen. I had people who would come up when I was about to give like an evening presentation, and they would come in and they'd look around and they'd be like, "Oh, they got you working so late. I thought housekeeping would have gone by now." Right. And then I'd be up 10 minutes later presenting. Or like whenever the people in the kitchen would cook bacon, folks would always compliment me that day on my bacon. So like I had those times when I was like, how am I, like, maybe this is not the space for me. How am I ever going to move forward in my career if when people, when they come to an environmental center, what they think of when they see me is, oh, this person does that. This person isn't like director material. This is the type of job they must be doing. And I had a real crisis of self in those spaces where I questioned if this was the field that I should be working in and the position that the positions I should be working in conservation. And I didn't know how we could solve or start thinking about identity-based experiences within conservation and environmental education. And now, you know, I really feel like I've had a space where I was able, like, I was very scared to think about working on my own, right? I was very scared to think about stepping out of that day job. There's so many things like healthcare and like, what do you, how are you going to provide? I've got three kids and a family. And how would I contribute to that? And so it was very hard to think about being in the position that I'm in now. But I was able to take that leap and figure those things out, you know, so I could. And now I feel like, you know, it's been so much fun throughout my career to do things like lead kayaking trips or bike tours or, you know, just be outside every day teaching people about nature. But I honestly feel like the work that I'm doing now is the most important thing that I could be doing to save the planet. Because when we talk about conservation and the environment, we don't have everyone at the table. We don't have everyone involved in the conversations about climate change and all of these things that are facing us as communities, as nations, and as people who live on this planet. And until we can have productive conversations around what community engagement looks like, what inclusive science communication looks like, so on and so forth, we're not going to get there. So I was able to cross this fear and get into a space where I feel like I am doing things, even, you know, things that I've only dreamed of before. And I think, but like the rivers keep going, right? There's always a new thing to cross. And so I still am working on, like, what is the end result of what I hope to have happen when we talk about true equity within the field and, you know, working, moving towards that. And there's that river's got a lot of stuff in it. to navigate.
No doubt. You haven't mentioned this phrase, but imposter syndrome, the layers of, do I belong here? There's uncountable layers to that for you.
And for a lot of people, yeah, in different ways.
I love how you've turned those hard feelings into, like, let's save the world. That's, like, the best thing ever. Like, your USU is really not just about you, but making the world a better place for everyone else. And I just think it's really admirable.
Oh, well, thank you. Trying.
I'm very impressed. I'm very pleased to be sitting at a picnic table with you next to a lake.
I'm excited to be here too. It's cool under the trees.
Yeah.
It's really nice. Cottonwoods.
Did you have anything that you wanted to say about imposter syndrome to my listeners who also experience imposter syndrome?
Yeah. It took me a while to figure out that everyone is just making it up as they go along.
The big
like
secret.
Everyone, even like I get into spaces, I think, so, okay, here's the thing. Everyone makes it up as they go along. Some people are taught better and early on that how to mask that, and that you know, their first thought can be the best thought or whatever, right? And so you see people that go into situations and they're just riffing, they're just saying, you know, they have ideas, they're not afraid to throw those ideas out, and they're not afraid for, you know, like they feel like those ideas are going to be taken at face value. And I think that there's a lot of us that are taught that we are not at that level, and that we need to think or use like certain language that always allows you, like, you know, an exit, a back door. Like, I, you know, for years, and I still do it today, I try not to, but in my communication, it's like, well, I think that this might be a good idea. Here's my idea. If you think maybe we could do, okay, I'll leave now. Right? And, you know, there's a lot of people who are taught that, no, you know, you're supposed to be confident. And you just go in and you're like, hey, here we go. Here's a proposal, you know, and, you know, folks are like, this is great, you know, but when you don't have that confidence in yourself, I think it makes it easier for people to not, to also not have that confidence.
Yeah.
In you.
I call it pretend confidence, where you're really not confident and you're really scared, but you don't show it and you just pretend that you're confident.
Take it till you make it.
I'm rallying against fake it till you make it, because you have to do it until you're doing it. Like, are you faking it if you're doing it?
Oh, okay.
Here you are.
You are doing it. You are doing it. I mean, when you say fake it till you make it, you're doing something, right? And hoping that people, when they see you, think you're doing it too.
Faking it brings fear into the definition of that you're not able to do this thing, so that you shouldn't be here in this space doing this thing.
Yep. No, I hear that.
Do it till you're doing it.
Do it till you're doing it.
That's my new one.
Do it till you do it. Do it till you're done.
So it's not as good or catchy. No one's making that sticker. Dang.
Maybe. You could be the first.
I got a lot of stickers I got to make. Need to make more money, make more stickers. I want to go back to what we were talking about before with the national parks. I'm curious because a lot of things are like in flux since the great unpleasantness of the past couple years.
The great unpleasantness.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, sorry.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
The great unpleasantness.
And accessing things like national parks and some of the more popular trails in the national forest, they've added more hoops to jump through before you can show up. Yep. Right now you have to plan ahead,
like timed entry,
timed reservations.
Yep.
And like no one's really explaining that that's not your entry fee and you have to have a reservation and pay more money just to get in there.
Yeah.
Do you think the people doing this are taking into account underserved populations as much as they should? Are we losing out on access?
I think it is. There's definitely a group of folks that are missing out because when, you know, like I talked about not knowing what a national park was until I got older, right? And passing by a space like that or being in a community with a space like that, you know, it's sometimes people's first experiences or access is like, what's that thing? Maybe I will stop and go, right?
Yeah.
And so it ends up with the people who are already in the know, who already understand the system,
right,
being the ones that can get what they need to do the experience.
Sure.
And people who don't know get turned away, and then they're like, oh, well, you know.
Too bad.
Too bad. I guess I wasn't meant to go to wherever that was. No. But, you know.
I feel like that's not good enough. I feel like we could do better.
Yeah. You know, I think, again, it really has to do with what people know, what people are exposed to. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have folks at the table with differing points of view, right, who can speak to those things, then it's hard to design spaces, programs, policies that are reflective of everyone, yeah, right? And when we think about like our current systems that we have now, like a lot of the oppression that we see is because of that. I said earlier, when we build systems, we build things that are reflective and comfortable to us, right? And our identities. And when we think about, well, who built this thing, right? Who set the rules for this thing and who is thriving within that system, we can usually tell, right? And it happens in a lot of little ways. Like I was doing a presentation a few weeks ago at an organization. It was on the second floor of their building. There were only stairs to access that space. There was no elevator. That space was designed probably by an able-bodied architect,
sure,
designed with able-bodied people in mind. And as an able-bodied person going into that space, right, it, like 10 years ago, I would not have noticed that there wasn't an elevator. Because when you have privilege within a space, you don't think about, like, it's not even that, oh, this is easy for me. It's just that we just think about that's doesn't, how it is.
It doesn't even cross your mind,
right? But someone who comes into that space who is a wheelchair user, right? They were not thought of in that space. They were not planned for in that space. And they would not, you know, utilize that space well. And people might do things like, oh, well, you know, we can solve this. Well, how about we'll carry you up to the second floor and then carry your wheelchair up, right? When we think about the ways that we try to retrofit policies and things to make it, oh, well, we didn't plan for this group, but we'll try and retrofit a thing. We'll put a policy in that, you know, if they fill out these forms, there'll be someone at the bottom of the stairs to, you know, carry them in. But that doesn't really feel good for the person who wasn't thought of in the system, right? And doesn't usually go perfectly for them. But and then when people like complain about something, they're like, this does not work for us. You know, we say, well, you should be lucky to feel, you know, that you got to be here, or, you know, we're trying the best that we can. What do you think that we should be doing? The building just wasn't built that way. Instead of really considering from the beginning, how do we get everyone at the table? How do we make sure that we stop building spaces and creating spaces where not everyone is represented, you know, so that we can make better spaces that are more inclusive? Spaces, places, organizations, so on.
Right on. And the people building stuff, they're just building stuff the way it's been done because that's how it's done.
Yeah.
So we need more money behind actually caring for everyone.
Yeah. It's another thing that's being inclusive is not thought of as being synonymous with money. But that's also the reason why I created the or co-founded with Crystal Eggly the Inclusive Guide.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to give, finally have an economic lever to inclusion. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times inclusion is thought of as a nice to have or something that we do because it warms our heart strings, right? But finally giving people an opportunity, if you have certain identities and you want to look for spaces that have been welcoming and inclusive to people like you, now finally there's a way to be able to look up that information. And we also give businesses information because a lot of times businesses don't know who they're serving well and who they're not. So because of our the way our platform's set up, we can tell them, hey, you're doing really well with Asian men, but white women in wheelchairs are having trouble in your space. And this is what they're saying about their experiences. So finally, there is an economic lever because we can choose which businesses to support. Sure. And businesses that maybe are seeing that, oh, you know, we're not getting business from a certain group. And now we know that for a fact because the numbers are telling us, well, try to make an effort, right, to be inclusive so that they can gain that other business. They can see the economic incentive to it.
So tell us a story. I've been following you on the Instagram.
Okay. On the gram.
On the gram. And you were traveling across the country with your family.
Yes.
you called it vacation, but I know you're yes. you're like musicians in that you're traveling, but you're also
the liberation tour.
You're also working though too.
Yep.
Right. And it's funny because a lot of our work looks like relaxing to everyone else, but I love the struggle stories. I'm a collector of struggle stories. Where did you struggle the most on that trip?
We had environmental struggles and we had people struggles, right?
Ooh, yeah. So
our very first night on the trip, we stopped in Kansas and there was a tornado. and so we're like, all right, touche, Kansas, touche. My kids, we had to stay for 2 hours in a concrete shower house while it just like hailed and rained and had branches whipped against the door and water pouring in from under the door. It was quite an event. And my kids at the end were like, can we go home? And we're like, no, 16 more days. We got to a place in the really deep south. When we got to the campground, they had a lot of signage about their political views, including that they didn't think our current president was really president. And when I got on to the site, they had things like, you know, they had totem poles as decoration. They had a raw cotton display in there. Their laundry room. So they had some things that really gave me pause. I got followed. So my husband, who is white, took our kids to go fishing. I decided to walk around and just kind of, you know, see what the campsite was about. And I started getting followed by a black SUV that, like, every time I stopped, they stopped. Every time I walked, they walked. When I went down a different road, they followed me down that road. This is just on the campground.
Damn.
And eventually, after being followed for about 15 minutes, I was like, okay, the next people that I see, I'm going to stop and talk to them. And so I did. And then the SUV went on.
Huh.
And so we had some kind of hard experiences. We stopped by some places that I think back in the day, people probably considered kitschy. Today, it's kind of racist. We stopped by a place called South of the Border, which is themed. They have a a Mexican man in a sombrero as their mascot. They call him Pedro, and it was just on everything. Pedro says, do this. You could go up.
Everything is a stereotype.
Yes, everything's a stereotype on the border between South Carolina and North Carolina. Huh. There's a giant sombrero that you could like ride up to the top, and they had like a motel and gas stations and museums and like lots of kitschy tourist shops.
Sure.
And so it just was interesting to like come across that place in 2022 and be like, oh, you know?
It's still here. Why are people still coming?
Why are people still coming to this place? There were those experiences, and then there were also very good experiences. And I definitely think our good experiences outweighed the bad experiences on the tour. And I'm glad because we wanted, like, I had never been in an RV, first of all. And I drove that thing through we went out from Colorado to the East Coast and then back again. And I drove it the entire time because I get car sick really badly. And I drove it. I had never taken an RV trip or done any like tour of national parks or anything when I was a kid. And it was very important to me to give those experiences to my children.
Yeah.
So they have a frame of reference as they grow up in the world.
And that's really good, and they will. So I grew up, my family came to Rocky Mountain National Park because my dad's parents, my grandparents, would bring them to this park.
Yeah.
So there's like a whole family history, and unless someone starts it, it doesn't happen.
Exactly.
And when I go there, it feels really special, and I like wave to my grandparents because I feel like their spirits are still there. So I think
I love that.
You might not even know the difference that you're making for your kids right now by doing that. Actually, I think you do, but someday maybe they'll tell you.
Someday maybe they'll tell me.
That's awesome.
Not today, but...
Oh, yeah. That takes a while.
I was like, what was your favorite part of the RV trip? They're like, when we stayed the night in the hotel.
The real bed.
The real bed.
All right. Yeah.
Like, okay, kiddos.
Yeah. When I see, like, especially as a Jew, there has been more anti-Semitism in this country recently than I feel like when I was growing up. And I feel like one of the things that white people could do is to follow your site and not support places perpetuating ridiculous stereotypes, even if we're not the ones who are the most uncomfortable in that space. I feel like we should all become subscribers. And what do we have to do to do that?
The site is called inclusiveguide.com. And I'm so glad that you said that because we do, oftentimes we have white folks that are like, oh, can we use the guide? And it's actually very important for us, for white folks, to use the guide, fill out the identity information, and rate businesses themselves, because we need to see, so not only support the businesses that are being inclusive, but rate businesses on their experiences, because what we need to see is a baseline, right? We need to be able to see a baseline and say, oh, you know, maybe this business just has really bad customer service, treats everyone.
There are those businesses
that treat everyone awful. And then if I could see that, when we look at these people with these certain identities have notably different ratings than people with these other set of identities, then we can really start to see trends within businesses and give businesses information that could be beneficial to them. So we need everyone on the guide, everyone rating the guide, And filling out that profile identity information is really helpful as well.
Do we have to create an account? Can anyone just go on this?
Yeah. Okay. Anyone can go on. The verification is through a text message. Mm-hmm. So they need to have a phone that they can get a text message from. And we thought that was really important because we don't want people to create fake accounts and then spam certain spaces. Yeah. So it's tied to a cell phone, mm-hmm. right? But people can get on, create an account, start rating.
Cool. So all right, listeners, get on there. Do it. Inclusive Guide.
InclusiveGuide.com.
.com.
We need a jingle. All right, musicians.
Well, let's work on it. Yeah. So you're also a climate activist, and I was listening to BBC on the way here, and they were talking about how we have definitively passed the point where the water levels will rise,
yes.
and it's going to affect billions. They said billions of people. I'm particularly thinking of countries like Bangladesh, where there's a lot of people at sea level who are very poor.
Yeah.
And there's so much of this environmental, and I've interviewed climate scientists on this podcast, and I'm very surprised always at how optimistic they seem when I talk to them. Like, how
climate
do you?
Climate crisis.
It's a climate crisis. The crisis is real. How do you stay positive when it seems like the outlook is so bleak for so many people?
I think it can be very hard to stay positive, and it is difficult, especially when you are seeing efforts that are not including everyone, right? Because when we think about who is most affected by these issues, right? And that's here in the United States. We think, you know, there are countries overseas that are going to be devastated with it. And here in the U.S. as well.
Florida,
they
right? won't even Any say climate coastline. Change.
They won't, no. I lived on the eastern shore of Virginia, and it was the same. It was very hard to get the people who lived in those spaces, were highly affected, were very poor, a lot of folks of color, to have an understanding of it, even though they noticed the change over time. So mm-hmm. like these same people who are watermen would notice that, oh, you know, this dock, we've had to move the dock, and this area, like the island that I lived on, used to be this large, and now, you know, these houses on the edge, or we've had to move people, move them, you know, they've had to go up on stilts, all of these things. They notice the change, but they have been so completely told that, you know, and kind of taught to think that it is not real and it's not something to talk about or to worry about. It's been politicized, and that makes it really, really sad, because some of the people that are most affected,
right.
who are lower socioeconomic backgrounds, are denying it. And then we get people who in themselves are kind of defenseless, because they are dealing with their day-to-day, a lot of young queer kids of color, people with disabilities. We often do not talk about the disabled community in our conversations about the climate crisis. So yeah, it's sad to me and scary to me. And I try to think about, what are successes that we are having, and what are ways that we can connect as humans. Like, those are some of the best conversations that I see, and the most ways that we can make progress, when it is certain language, right? And I talked earlier about inclusive science communications.
Mm-hmm.
When it's certain language, it is hard for people to connect to the message. And so figuring out better ways to communicate certain issues, I think, and seeing those small successes, I think, are the things that keep me going.
Right on. Those small, that's what I'm saying, those small imperceptible steps, that gets us to the other side of the river of suck.
And it's also what I feel about, okay, when I think about solving issues, social justice issues like racism, climate justice, environmental justice, all of these things. When I think about that utopian where we have a clean environment and we have this and that, somebody told me several years ago, I think some of the best advice that I've ever heard, and it was that for these big issues, I may never see the end result, right? And I think it is really, it gets really disheartening when I think of, oh, I want us, like people talk about us being post-race, and we're not, right? But no. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
And like, what is our post-racial society, utopian, like where we're dealing with climate change and we're dealing with these social justice issues and we're making the changes within our communities that have to be made, like, and I may never see that. And so instead of thinking of it as a race that I'm running as hard as I can to get to the end, this person said you should think of it more like a relay race. And it is your job to run the fastest leg that you can so that the person who you're passing the baton to maybe is that much closer to the end and able to really solve those issues. And it's not to say that it lets me off the hook because I have to run as fast as I can. I have to work as hard as I can to solve these issues so that we have just a chance of getting it pulled together in time. But it also makes me feel a little bit lighter and a little bit better because my endpoint, it doesn't become a failure if on my deathbed I look up and I don't see that post-racial, gotten climate change under control. Like I don't see that perfect society. It doesn't mean that my work wasn't valuable and important.
Right on. Speaking of failure and mistakes.
Speaking of failure.
What is a mistake and what is failure?
Like to me?
Yeah.
I think a mistake is an opportunity to learn and grow. And I don't think it's an indictment on who I am as a person, because if I've made a mistake, then I've had an opportunity to learn to do it better. And I work very hard to not make the same mistake twice. A failure to me is losing hope and losing heart for this really important work that has to be done. And I think as long as I can keep hope and heart together, then whatever happens, I'm going to deem it as a success. So.
Yeah. Love that. All right. We got a question from the River of Sucks swim team. This is someone who lives in a city and is not a big outdoors person.
Okay. I love it.
Rob asks, how can musicians get involved in anti-racist environmental activism?
Yeah. So I love that you said that they live in the city and they're not really an outdoorsy person. Because I used to think of myself that way. I grew up in the Bronx. And I used to think that I was not a very outdoorsy person because I didn't do the things that we typically see as being outdoorsy.
Right.
And it wasn't until later and re-examining and thinking of my childhood that I realized that I was hella outdoorsy. Like we spent a lot of time walking the streets of New York, right? Thinking about the
streets are outside.
The streets are outside. Just because we put some concrete over it doesn't mean it's not nature. And I got my sense of place in the streets of the Bronx and got an environmental message. I used to walk collecting cans with my dad, aluminum cans, because back in the day, in the 80s, you could give the cans back and get 5 cents a can. So we collected it for money. We needed the money. And along the way, I noticed that there was other trash on the ground that we were leaving behind. I noticed in my neighborhood, the cans were on the ground. But if you went to nicer neighborhoods, the cans were in the trash can that you'd have to dig through, right? I noticed that there were, like, the way my neighborhood was designed, and we know now, you know, the Bronx, there's been lots of studies about asthma and environmental factors in the Bronx, but I knew that my neighborhood had some issues, and I kept bugging my parents about it, and they were like, I don't know why there's trash on the ground. Why don't you write a letter to the New York Times?
Ooh.
And so I did. I wrote this letter when nice. I was 9 to the New York Times that was very impassionate. And it wasn't until years later, after being in my career and looking back, that I was like, oh, wait, no, I went outside. I cared about my environment even then, even before I had an environmental education class, even before I went to a national park. But those experiences I didn't think of as being outside or outdoorsy or environmentally minded, because it wasn't what we traditionally show. So that's a long story short to say that I would challenge the idea of, because of where we live or because we don't get out on the top of a mountain, that we're not outdoorsy.
Yeah.
And then the actual question was, how can people get into this work? And I think that it is closer than you think or you've been led to believe. So even if you live in an urban area, there's often a lot of environmental issues that are separated and stratified out by race. And so, like, if we look in Denver, mm-hmm. Which is where I live currently, there is a CDC life expectancy map.
Yeah.
And if you look at the CDC life expectancy map and the overlay, you can see that there we have one neighborhood, mostly people of color. The average life expectancy for the state is 80 years. The life expectancy in that neighborhood is 72 years. You go to the more wealthier neighborhood. And I'm going to say, like, the first neighborhood I'm talking about is Globeville, Elaria, Swansea. The second neighborhood, Cherry Creek, life expectancy is 85, 86 years.
Wow.
Mostly white, right? There are huge environmental factors in both areas. If you look at the first neighborhood, predominantly people of color, very urban, industrial, very low tree cover. In some areas, it's like 2% tree cover.
Yeah.
Down in Cherry Creek, white, affluent, mostly like up to 60% tree cover. Globeville area had been redlined, right? And so the resources that were in that area were severely diminished. And a lot of times what happens in cities that were redlined, and redlining, for people who don't know, it was a discriminatory practice back in the day, after segregation, really in an effort to stymie all of the desegregation that was happening in areas. They kind of drew red lines around certain neighborhoods. The most defining factor of those neighborhoods is that they were predominantly black, and they wouldn't give white people like loans to go into those areas to build businesses or to have houses. They would give really bad and predatorial loan things for black people that made it almost impossible to invest in their own neighborhoods. And so those neighborhoods ended up underdeveloped. And then many, many years later, after that practice was kind of struck down, cities then had these areas that were underdeveloped, and certain industries would come in, like factories, and be like, oh, where can we build? And they would say, oh, well, this area underdeveloped. We've been trying to think of something to do with it. Why don't you build over there? And the people in the areas normally didn't have enough voice or political sway or whatever to get those things not built in those areas. And so when we think about that low life expectancy for this predominant neighborhood of color, it also is near a bunch of factories that prey on the air quality. People say they come out and they have like orange soot on their car, you know, several times a week from air quality issues. And so, like, thinking about those things, how does that show up in your urban area? Because that has an effect on the environment, on the people in those areas. And that is a way to plug in and think about environmental and social justice areas, places that are close to you. I think the other thing is, how are people listening to the voices of people most affected? Like, one easy way to start opening up your eyes to different perspectives is just to get on social media and look up what are different identity groups that you don't normally follow. I'm on TikTok. You can easily go into TikTok and use different hashtags, like for Black creators, Asian creators, creators with disabilities, creators in the queer community, and that starts giving you like just insight into other people's experiences and helps you to understand and know what are things that I may not have been exposed to that I can support and work on.
Cool.
Don't ask me a question. I'm going to give you a long answer.
We love it. It's a podcast. We say words on podcast.
We say words.
Thanks, Rob, for that question. And, you know, as you're saying all that, it's very much true of where the space that we're in right now, Commerce City, which is full of refineries and some of the worst air quality. I feel like in this wildlife refuge with the wind, like, we're probably pretty good here. But from what I've heard, if you went a couple miles that way, you know, I had to drive past a couple of refineries to get here. And like, it smells bad.
Yep.
And I can't imagine having to live near that. So I don't always know what to do about it, but I feel it.
And these people in these communities, like not these people, our people, our neighbors, our family members, our siblings, that are living in these communities are not getting their voices heard when they suggest solutions or talk about things. There's a recent video that came out, put out by three Native-led organizations here in Denver about Suncor, which is a major industry, major refinery. They have been out of compliance with the EPA for several years.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of political things that go into forcing industries to stand up to even the little things. Like, that's not a, you know, they're trying to call attention to the fact that there is an issue because they're acting out of compliance, but they don't have the voice to have that be heard. But if it was in another neighborhood, you know, that voice, that political sway, right, because is like secondhand.
Yeah. So there is that, but there's the big business is big business here in Colorado. Yeah. I used to live in Boulder County. I was living in Louisville, and I remember voting for counties and towns being able to say, we don't want fracking in our town. Yeah. And so the politicians in Denver, in the state, said, no, you can't decide that. We can frack wherever we want.
Yeah.
We could say Boulder is one of the most affluent zones around here, right? There's, and no one's talking about this, there's a mine, an active mine in Nederland, above Nederland, where they're just like leaking toxic waste. And Boulder has sued the company saying, hey, this is our watershed.
Yep.
You can't do that. And the company has said, well, we'll get to it in a couple of years. So, you know, these problems of environment and health.
Yep.
The thing is, it happens more to people in worse economic situations and people of color. But it happens
everywhere,
and it's really hard to escape. And here in this state, no one ever cleaned up the gold rush. There's piles of arsenic everywhere. That's what those yellow piles are. If you look around on I-70, those are all piles. Yeah. Piles of arsenic from the gold rush. No one cleaned it up. So
weird.
I know. If you want to get scared,
you're going to have to go to the Googs after this.
Go to the Google. Check out the map of closed oil drilling in Colorado, and you're going to see all across the population centers, wells, mines. It's just, it's hard.
And it's interesting. Like, so those two things have definitely shocked me. I'm always interested, like, when people tell me those statistics, and I think about, like, wow, we're taking all of this fuel out of the earth, and, like, what if, like, it has to be there? Mm-hmm. Like, what if, like that, you know, like, there's, like, something way down deep in the middle of the earth that, like, stops turning, some like center stops, some ball starts, mm-hmm. stops rolling. What's at our core, right?
Yeah. Like,
and we use so many of our resources and we're like, oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. And then, you know, we have earthquakes. We have all of these other things that slowly start to encroach on us, the climate crisis, all of these things. And we're like, just like, oh, it's still okay. We're still going to make it. Right?
I like the idea that Mother Earth is alive.
Yeah.
And that she can feel what's happening. And if you think of the Earth and our planet like that, you might think twice before you do something bad.
For draining all her lifeblood.
Yeah.
Drive to the grocery store.
We're in it deep. We're holding cell phones.
Yep.
Whatever metals had to come together here for us to have to stream to the internet next to a link. I don't know. They're hard questions, and none of the answers are simple. That's one of the things that really strikes me is there's nothing about any of this is simple. There's no easy answers, but I think my hope is that if we talk about it more and raise awareness, and the more people care about it, the more people vote, register, because it's not just about you. Other people like life and existence too, and we want to...
I think, you know, the other thing about the River of Suck, like we can think about climate change and the environmental issues as being along that river, and a big thing about the River of Suck is that you don't always know what's on the other side.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you have an idea, right? And I think that's why a lot of people don't swim, a lot of people don't cross, because of the unknown. And when we think about the environmental changes that need to make, or the climate changes that need to make, a lot of people are saying, well, I know what's on this side of the river, and I'm not guaranteed that if I go through this like super hard thing of maybe giving up some of the creature comforts that I've grown, you know, to love, or, you know, changing this thing, like I'm not assured that there's going to be something as good as I have now on the other side. So they're like too scared to make that crossing. And the horrible thing about it is that we need to make it together, right? This is not a one-off. A lot of people are like, when you start talking about things, they're like, well, why don't... Oh, well, I see. Like, you know, you said, oh, well, we have these things. And it's true. Like, we do have cell phones. We're speaking in a microphone right now, right? And people, like, think of that as a gotcha. Like, sometimes when they're having these conversations, they'll be like, oh, well, there's nothing. Like, you're not doing anything, right?
Or right.
If you believe it so much, you go off and live in a hut. but it doesn't work that way. This is one river that we have to get a lot more of us to cross together.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
We're in it together. Thank you so much again, Parker Queenwork, for speaking with me today. It's been so ridiculously fun. And not only fun, I feel better.
Oh.
I feel happier and more optimistic somehow. And sitting next to the water and hearing these bugs.
Yes.
Sing their songs.
Sounds like cicada time.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I was very excited to be here, and I hope to not only keep in touch with you, but, you know, any of your listeners who like what they heard. If they want to come and check me out, I'm on social media under Queenwork, which is KWEENWERK on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. And so they can check out that or check out the queenwork.com website. They should definitely check out inclusiveguide.com and give some reviews on there. Let us know what you think. Actually, we need people to go on there and break our website. We still have our software engineers that are working on bug fixes and stuff. So the more bugs people come across and let us know, the better the website. And they could also check out ecoinclusive.org to find out more about my conservation-based diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice trainings and consulting.
Amazing. Go check it out, everybody. Nobody ever said crossing the River of Suck would be easy or that you had to do it alone. So I want to thank you for tuning in and giving it a chance. You can join the River of Suck swim team for just $1 a month at riverofsuckswimteam.com. Get extra fancy bonus content. Support this podcast. Keep it going. Thanks again to my special guest, Queen Work, Parker. Till next time,
keep swimming.
Yeah. Swimming?
Keep swimming. Keep swimming.
I don't know. I didn't know there was.
Just keep swimming. Just keep swimming. Just keep swimming.
What is that from? Someone else did that. I have no idea what it's from.
I think it's from Finding Nemo.
Oh. Oh. Okay. Wow. It took me like a couple years to get that right. Someone did that.
Love it.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Queen Work. Special shout out to my interns at the CU Boulder English Department, Riley Mercer and Taylor Henry, for all their hard work behind the scenes. Make sure you're following River of Suck Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. We're posting all the time, interview highlights, daily affirmations, quotes from our brilliant guests. Don't forget, visit magicmind.co/river and use our special code RIVER20 for life-changing green shots. Coming up next time, my conversation with professional skier and cliff-jumping world record holder Julian Carr. Till next time, keep swimming and remember, the stoke is real.